Today in Flex in the City,
we talk to Noel Fessy, CEO of European Fund Administration. Don't allow the regulatory imperative to distinguish agency and the power of the people, says Noel.
All that happening right now in Flex and the City.
Hello, everybody. This is Rachel Treese for Flex in the City, and I am really thrilled this afternoon to have somebody who is the most fabulous leader in financial services. He's a little bit shy, and his name is Noel Fessy, and he is the Chief Executive Officer of European Fund Administration. Noel, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Rachel. And it's true, I am shy. I'm that shy person that can stand up in a room of 1,000 people on a stage and speak with some confidence and enjoyment, but I'm really quite uncomfortable speaking on a record and being recorded in a much more private one-to-one style. So bear with me.
Well, thank you for being vulnerable. And I think, Noel, you'll agree that growth often happens when we get pushed out of our comfort zone. So I'm going to really enjoy our conversation this afternoon. So I do know quite a bit about you, but I'd love to know a little bit about, you know, your journey from, you know, childhood and how you ended up doing the job that you are doing now.
It's quite a long story, and there's quite a lot of fortune in that journey. If I was to take it right back to birth, I'm the son, one of three children of parents who started out quite low on the economic ladder, so much so that when I and my twin brother were born, my sister was sent home to Ireland to live with grandparents because my parents had no money to keep and feed her at the same time as us. So we've come a long way, I suppose, over the last 55 years. My father served in the military, and in a sense, I am a child of the Cold War. One of my early memories is as a five-year-old living in West Berlin, the height of the Cold War. And regularly, I do remember the sirens going off and the soldiers preparing to deploy as they practiced the beginning of a hotter form of war. And after that, we lived in West Germany and regularly, well, surrounded by military equipment and the preparations for war with fast jets flying over the family home, etc. So I suppose it was a deeply unoriginal thing that I did at the end of my school career, which was to join the army. I went to Sandhurst and spent 14 years in the British Army, following my father originally by being posted myself to West Germany as a participant in that Cold War, waiting for the Russians to come. They never did come, did they? Or at least they came very late. Mm-hmm. Base. And through that military career, through a whole variety of different postings and roles, including obtaining a degree in computing, for want of a better description, I developed as an individual. And I think that the Army, in many respects, in those early years, shaped a lot of my thinking and how I go about my work. I left the Army after 14 years because I'd reached a point where I'd been selected for higher staff training. And if you accept that invitation, you have to serve for quite a lot of years beyond the point that the training finishes. So that would, for me, have been a decision to remain in the Army for a full career. And I felt that I would somehow be incomplete, notwithstanding that the privilege of higher staff training and getting two more degrees, that somehow I needed to do something else in order to prove to myself that that I was capable of succeeding in business or the business world. So I left it and was very fortunate to have got a job with Schroders, the asset manager, the British asset manager. Yeah. Initially, head of IT security, global head of IT security, because that was similar to the work that I was doing in my last job in the military. And thereafter, that grew until I came to Luxembourg, nearly 20 years ago. And I think that probably brings us up to date.
Wow. So one of the things that I'm very curious about, so you've been working, been in Luxembourg for 20 years, but I'm really curious about what can financial services leaders learn from the military? You were a leader in the military, you've been a leader in financial services. What do you think leaders in our industry can learn?
I think one of the first things to say is that the military, whatever branch of whatever nation, and here we're mostly talking in my experience about Western nations, the military doesn't have a monopoly on great ideas for leadership, and nor does it necessarily reliably produce great leaders. I think that military organisations, like business organisations, are human, and therefore they have the strengths and weaknesses that reflect the people that they employ, the individuals that they employ, and so are capable of great excellence. And from time to time, they struggle to lead well. And that's probably both an individual and an organizational point. But from my experience, and from the very early days of my military career, it was very people oriented. You were expected to know your people really well, and right in the detail, just not to know them just as soldiers or just as you would do in a business, an administrator or an accountant, but to know what drives them, motivates them, where their strengths and weaknesses lie, and you would, again, in the military, put them first, in a sense that making sure that their needs were properly met was important, both on, a human level, but also on an organizational level. If people are happy and capable and well looked after, then they will perform well for themselves, for the unit, and for their colleagues. And there was, at the heart of the Sandhurst curriculum, a sense of servant leadership.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So that point that you do serve to lead. That's the motto of that place: serve to lead. And I think that way of thinking influenced me quite significantly. And I think that I continue that today. So a lot of what I do in my job in IFA is to identify, enable, support, encourage people to be the best that they can be, and not to treat them as somehow some form of a human robot, where you assign them a task and then supervise the satisfactory execution of that task before moving on to the next task. That for me seems to be too shallow. So that's a little bit where I come from. I don't think, back to this point about financial services or civilian organizations, I think many really great civilian organizations completely understand that point, and do regard their people as being seriously important and take very substantial steps to develop them as people, not simply as accountants or what have you.
So this probably leads me on to something that I know you're really passionate about, and you certainly taught me an awful lot, and that's the power of agency. So for some listeners out there, they may never have heard the word agency and may not know what that means within organisations. So could you articulate a little bit more about what you believe the power of agency is, Noel?
Yeah, well, we were having a conversation separately the other day, weren't we, about the difference between empowerment and agency. Yeah. Empowerment is something with which I think most people will be familiar. Empowerment's very much about encouraging people to exercise power using individual discretion and a degree of autonomy inside an organization. So empowerment's a good thing, yeah? The reason why I think I prefer agency is I think that empowerment for me is not enough to get the very best from people or to help people to be the very best that they can be. Because empowerment for me is something given from above. It's granted by higher managers and for all of the best intentions. Mm. And that's an external thing in a sense. Empowerment comes from the organization. It's a permit granted to an individual. And I think that isn't enough to help people grow. It certainly is a utilitarian model for maximizing outcomes. Mm-hmm. It certainly allows people to exercise freedom, which they will enjoy, and it helps them grow to some degree. But agency is a different thing, because human agency for me, and I think once your listeners I've heard the term, I think they'll become a little bit more aware of it when they see it next time, because it does come up in business organizational theory, and also actually you'll find it indeed even in the press. Agency is about a person's individual capacity to make a difference and to do so with their own free will, with exercising effective self-regulation, emotional self-regulation, and with real belief in their own efficacy, so that they believe they can make a difference. That's where the capacity comes from. And that, I can do this, I know I can do this, I know I should do this. And to do all of that within the organization, so in a way that makes sense to the organization, because agency is not about, in this sense, in organizational theory, it's not about the unconstrained realization of personal desire or ambition. It's got to make sense. And finally, it's got to come in collaboration with others. And the key thing, and the difference from empowerment, if you like, the step forward from empowerment, is that human agency, being innate, really develops the individual power. And it is very powerful. And one of the things that I like to do as a leader in the company is to create the conditions in which people can exercise that. And it's a form of encouragement first, and often by creating space, or often by reassuring people that some of the guide rails that other managers in their past might have installed as constraints, that those guide rails can be taken away, and that people can bring themselves much more fundamentally to the life of the company and help shape the firm. So in a sense, they don't come to just purely to operate a particular process or to work within some procedure that's been defined by some higher manager, but they actually come to help us shape the company, change those processes, and decide how best the company can execute its own mission.
So now, what do you think stops leaders creating a culture of agency?
Perhaps, in a company, when you have a relatively a new young manager, so you've elevated someone to management, it's really interesting to watch how they embark on that journey. Mm. I suppose how they do that depends upon the mental models that they have about what management and leadership is. If they've never been equipped, if no one has ever taken them through some basic ideas about what is leadership, how do you communicate with people, then some people may tend towards a rather directional, dirigiste type approach. Mm-hmm. To managing people, which isn't leadership. It's some people would prefer to give clear instruction, which is, I think, actually a perfectly legitimate management goal, and then to measure and monitor and adjust according to people's performance. But that's management in a rather technical sense, and it kind of assumes that the leader understands how to communicate goals and how to enable people. And if you haven't helped people, if you haven't helped your junior managers think about leadership, then what will they think apart from examples that they've seen and picked up? And I don't think that's a very satisfactory approach. So inside IFA, as you know, over the past couple of years, and even during the pandemic, with some trepidation at first, but with increasing delight, trepidation in the sense that we had to do this necessarily digitally. You know, we embarked upon a leadership development program, a learning and development program for our managers, taking them through about 26 hours of, in cohorts, 26 hours of development, where we helped them to understand various models of leadership and various models of communicating with people, to understand agency and why we wanted to give people the freedom to express themselves at work, so that they can be more productive in our company and that they can help shape our company. Why, in a sense, we as the more senior managers wanted to surrender to colleagues some of the initiative that previously had been reserved for the most senior levels. Why? Because we believe that we have 400 great people. And if we give those people the opportunity to join us in shaping the firm, then the firm will be stronger for it, and people will enjoy themselves and they will grow. And if we are serious about where our future leaders are coming from, and preferably they would come internally, then we should identify potential and do what we can to grow it, and to allow people to rise up and be the best leaders that we can possibly create from within. I think I've rather wandered there. I don't know. What was that? How was that for an answer?
That was a great answer. Great answer for me, definitely. I was involved. But do you think agency can create sustainable performance in organizations?
I think more so than the model, absolutely. Because the other models are, you know, it's one of the ways that I describe it. If you're not encouraging agency, then you are to some degree in a somewhat more directive management model. And the problem with that is that you induce a form of learned helplessness in your colleagues. And particularly, the more dirigist you become, the more prescriptive you become, the more you lean upon what I think are misguided models about how regulated companies should be controlled, and controlled precisely and right down in the detail, then the more you will rob people of the ability to use their initiative and intelligence. And remember, these people are often the closest to the operating reality of the business. They're the ones that understand how processes work well and how they dysfunction. Then the dirigist model is I think ultimately sterile. Ultimately, if you're thinking about growing the firm and growing the people within the firm, it doesn't mean it has zero utility. It can be effective because if you adopt highly prescriptive and directive models of management, then and particularly if you drill people, as I'm using some military phrases here, to follow those processes, then more senior management can be confident that the business will run as they designed it to run. But the problem with that, and it comes back to one of the other key themes that I use as I think about the firm, is that the problem with that, the moment you run into an ambiguous situation, the moment some uncertainty creeps into the execution of business, either because a system has failed or because things happen in markets, which they do in financial markets, the moment that your assumptions about the tracks upon which your procedures will run reliably, the moment those assumptions break, then people get stuck. And so the dirigist model is, I think, ultimately inflexible, or it lacks flexibility. which the agency model has in abundance. And I think that for me, there's a risky run in agency, which is that if you say to people, you are free within limits to exercise your initiative, that those limits are really the sort of the limits of the community. It's the limits are the limits of self-regulation and the need still to collaborate. There's no sole arbiter in any business, not even the CEO. Then when you give people that freedom and you must allow them to exercise it to some degree, you take a little bit of risk that they'll drive the company in directions that you would not prefer, that you would not individually choose. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong. You just need to be careful to communicate with people throughout that as the company grows and individuals develop, that we continue to communicate and make sure that we are reflecting with each other whether this is a successful and desirable path to choose. I'm going to take you back briefly to some military thinking, because I read a wonderful piece by Adam Tooze yesterday on Twitter. Adam is one of my heroes. I love his books. He also, in a sense, is a child of the Cold War, but he chose a very different path. He's an economist and historian who grew up in Germany, although he's English. And his piece yesterday was on something called mission command. It's a military concept born out of originally a German concept called Auftragstaktik, if I pronounce it correctly. A mission command is about allowing people at more junior levels in the organization to exercise initiative and discretion to determine a course of action free from the commander's intervention, provided that those people are fulfilling the commander's top-level desire, the mission, if you like. And in a sense, allowing human agency to come forward inside an organization is a way of ensuring that we have the people and the belief and the confidence necessary to introduce a form of business mission command. Now, as it happens in Adam's piece, he used the word agency. He said that mission command effectively grants to soldiers with ability, and that's the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, for example, of any army, it restores to them their agency, which otherwise is taken away by the fact that they are within a hierarchical command-oriented military force. And that agency is just so important.
So talking about developing people, Noel, I know you've got some theories, some thoughts about the best way of developing people. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, Noel?
Okay, well, I've got four steps, I think. And this is not a sequence, by the way. It's, okay. It's things I do, four different things that I do with people and that I also encourage my leaders to do as we develop the firm. Because companies, organizations, are in a sense, we talk about them having corporate identity, in a sense they're inanimate, but actually they're the product of human engagement, of people coming together and working together. So the first thing I do is to look for opportunities to advance and lift people. This is at its most satisfying when you take an individual and provide them with a career-defining appointment. I had a conversation recently with my chairman and with the board, we took one of our colleagues and appointed him to one of the most senior roles in the company, and we did so for this individual at the age of 36, and we did so because he is already able, very able, but he has potential for more. In thinking about how to develop this discussion with the board, because boards themselves, they have a variety of opinions. One of one of my concerns would be, as I've heard in the past, not on this board, but in other places, 36, that's very young. My view of advancement at an earlier age is that actually it's really essential. If you want to have great leaders in the future, you do need to make those really important decisions about who has the ability to go far. And you should raise them as soon as you possibly can, consistent with the organization's interest in being well managed. Because if you don't start giving 36-year-olds the experience to run at a senior level, then when do you ever expect them to? You're going to end up with a 45, 50-year-old who's never actually had an experience. And then you elevate them to senior leadership, too late. So I think it's important for leaders to look for opportunities, real ones. So this is not performative. You're taking a big step forward for the company and the individual and advance and lift them into a career-defining appointment as early as you can. You can't do that often. It's the very nature of organizations, but you should do it. Mm-hmm. And when you do it, you should be aware that you are really making a big difference to this person's life. So do it wisely and do it well, but have the courage to do it. The second thing is I think we should support and nurture people. And even as a CEO, I do this. And so it's you don't, the fact that you're a CEO doesn't put you at such a distance from other people that you cannot intervene to assist. So I've got one colleague at the moment where I think we have this individual has really got great potential, really intelligent, works hard, wants to get it right, and has a history of self-starting in a sense that tertiary education was pursued in sometimes quite challenging circumstances and successfully so. And this person has made a great contribution to our company, but there are some behaviors which will constrain this individual later in the career, if not addressed. And you'll notice I'm not using any gender pronouns here. I'm trying not to identify the individual too closely. But there are some things that we could do with that individual to help them understand themselves and to understand other people that will help them address those constraints to their success, which at the moment I think are somewhat technical in nature not insuperable barriers to advancement. But if they were allowed to go unaddressed, then in 3 to 5 years' time, the opportunity to advance further would probably have passed for that individual because they wouldn't have learned, they wouldn't have developed themselves. And so for that individual, we provided coaching and indeed several sessions of coaching, and we've been rewarded by a degree of growth there, both emotionally and intellectually, which means that the individual is much happier in the company, colleagues are much happier working with the individual, and we've got a far stronger technical and emotional and leadership-oriented person in the firm. So that support nurture component, in another place a long time ago, I remember having a career-ending conversation with someone and saying to my head of HR at the end of that process, if we'd have got to that person 10 or 15 years earlier, we wouldn't be having this conversation now. Yeah. And I think it is every leader manager, every leader's responsibility. If you see that developing, you really should do what you can to help that person along their path to growth. Because you may be doing them the favor of avoiding those difficult career conversations. And I think that's an obligation. I think there's a sort of moral obligation there on leaders to use their agency to help others. Back to the servant point, I think. Finally, I think as leaders, we need to push and develop people. And I've got the name of someone inside the company today who I felt was working in their comfort zone and very satisfactorily too. In other words, they were doing what they thought they should be doing. They were doing what their colleagues thought they should be doing. And they were doing it well, even from looking at it myself, thinking, well, this person does a very good job. But my point in discussion with them, and this is a one-on-one conversation with that individual, why don't you try doing a little bit more? Why don't you, in other words, the boundaries within which you're working are in a sense satisfactory and within the limits of your job description, but they're too limiting. You're better than this. Take a look at your work from this direction. Why don't you try to expand your scope of work into that domain? And I think in that conversation at the beginning, the individual didn't believe that they were permitted to do more. They didn't believe that they could step outside those boundaries. It's back to the guardrails that, that the job description and their understanding of their desk's function in the organization was that if they just do what they're supposed to do and everyone else does what they're supposed to do, then everything will be fine. And so we pushed that person to develop them, to get them to do something which initially when they first started to do it, I think they resisted in a sense. They were irritated by it. Why is the boss asking me to do this? And they're doing it now and thoroughly enjoying it. And their colleagues in the team, the broader team within which they work, are really value the contribution that they make in this new terrain. Mm-hmm. So push and develop people. So that's the first three: advance and lift, support and nurture, push and develop. And then finally, and it's the hardest one, it's the manage out. And in a sense, this may seem to be a contradiction to everything I've said about human growth, but sometimes it's just better for individuals and companies to take different paths. And that's one of the most difficult things that leaders must do is A, to come to that conclusion, and to do so thoughtfully, with empathy, honestly, challenging yourself that is this really the decision that we should take? It might not even be the only decision. There are often you see in companies people being parked in corners. Don't park people in corners. It's not great for them and it's not great for the company. And the most difficult thing is saying to someone, I think you should go. And you need to have that conversation in a really human way with respect and empathy. And if you approach it gently, then it can work in a way that whilst it's still a difficult message, there's no great rupture, there's no great drama. I think the individuals often will understand why you're having the conversation. But sometimes it can't be done quite so gently, and it needs a firmer hand and some determination. And I think that then is, if you like, the courage component of leadership. You still do it in a human way. There's no point having an aggressive discussion or a debate or a fight, but leaders have to have the courage to make those decisions sometimes, and managing people out. And because remember, you manage the company for all of its stakeholders, including equity, but particularly including all of your people. So we talk about managing for the 400, not for the one, and for your clients. So four steps: advance and lift, support and nurture, push and develop, and if you really must, manage out.
So there's a couple of things that you've mentioned up to now. You've mentioned servant leadership a few times, Noel. So I wanted to ask you about perhaps one of the greatest servant leaders, and we are just 1 week after the Jubilee celebrations in the United Kingdom. And I believe that this servant leader also has had the challenge of managing people out of the organization. So is the Queen one of the greatest leaders of all time? What's your view on the Queen as a servant leader, Noel?
Oh, that, you didn't warn me about that question. Oh, my word. I'm still on the regular Army Reserve of Officers list and until next October. So I'm going to answer that I think she is. Of course she is. It's a really difficult role. And she does give her all to the role. It's a model of selflessness, I think. I've seen servant leadership, and again, also in the military, I've seen examples of really superb servant leadership, and I've seen examples where clearly some of just didn't get the program. It's something that I've certainly taken on board. And if I was to think about some of my colleagues in financial services over the last 25 years, I'm not going to name them to save their blushes, but there are a couple in particular. Both of them were senior operations directors at Schroders, because they were just, A, so committed to the company's mission, but also their people. And both of them, I think, were masters, intuitively understood the idea of agency. One of them, for example, the one with whom I've worked the longest, called me many years ago on his first day in the role and simply said, "So what's your strategy? What's your strategy?" And I said, "Well, I don't have a strategy." I was the CEO in Luxembourg at the time. And I didn't have a strategy because I was had been given the mandate to run the firm according to the plan delegated to me by my senior line manager in London. And this new leader came in and said, "Well, you better get a strategy then. You know, I want you to tell me where this firm should go." And so that man lit the blue touch paper upon which we had 15 years of great fun, satisfaction, business, sometimes hard times. You know, it's not always easy, and that allowed us to develop the firm and many, many people's careers with it to create what was, and I think still is, under my current successor, a really super firm, high-performing and happy.
Fantastic. So that leads me on to the question about leadership in financial services. Do you think it needs to change, Noel?
I think it depends on the company. Financial services is special, but maybe similar to many other companies. We're highly regulated for a reason. We do things with people's money, and we have fiduciary obligations, which are really very serious. And so, in a sense, that regulatory imperative, which is becoming greater over time, so the regulators themselves are not only are they regulating more, but they're supervising more and they're enforcing more. That encourages a degree of prescriptive leadership, or at least management according to the rules and compliance, which, if you don't think about it very carefully, could be applied perversely to extinguish agency. Because effectively what you say is, these are the rules, do this and only this. And if you do that, I think you'd be making a mistake. And you, I suppose you would be able to justify it on the basis that, well, compliance brooks no dissent, do it or else. But I think agency is perfectly compatible with compliance. And so what I would say in financial services is don't allow the regulatory imperative to extinguish agency, because it will rob you of the true power of your people. Use the regulatory imperative to drive your agency decisions, to select the right people and develop them, because if they understand the compliance imperative, the regulatory demands, and if they are mature enough and they've grown as people, as humans, to apply those regulations and judge matters well, then you will have an inherently compliant organization. So in a sense, what I'm saying is that some financial services organizations do take a very dirigist approach. They do employ ranks of people at desks and require them to follow instructions very strictly. Is that they really should allow agency to play a role in that. Now, I think our listeners, you know, in a sense, we need to apply some caveats to that general appeal. So first of all, the appeal is fundamental and legitimate. And I think companies should hear it. Secondly, when people step outside procedures, when dealing with very large amounts of money, and things go wrong, they go wrong in spectacular ways. So I'm not suggesting that people be allowed to play fast and loose with financial risk or to throw large amounts of money around manually, sidestepping controls which have been placed there for good reason. Well, I suppose what I'm saying is that the agency component of human leadership is vital to making sure that when uncertainty does increase, when markets do throw surprises, when IT systems do fall over, you want people who are ready and able to respond and bring their wit, their intelligence, their humanity to the process to help the company to get back onto sure ground. The other thing I would say is probably finally, companies are the product of cultures which have evolved over very long periods, and they will also reflect national cultures. So I'm not sure that that I can give you a prescription or a recipe for doing better. I really do think, because companies are human constructs, it depends upon the people in the company at a point in time. But I would recommend two things. Looking up, reading a bit more about agency in general, and looking for it when you read the press, because you do see it sometimes, particularly if you're reading HR-oriented press. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, we inside IFA, we've put around about, I think it's 120 people now through this 26-hour management course, each in cohorts of 12 cohorts remaining together for the full 26 hours, and indeed even for refresher engagements afterwards. We give them a book by David Wilkinson called The Ambiguity Advantage. And The Ambiguity Advantage is a book which helps readers understand various leadership models and the strengths and limitations of each, from highly prescriptive technical leadership all the way through to what David calls generative leadership, which is where you're allowing a large amount of ambiguity and uncertainty present in your decision-making process, provided that you have dialogue with your colleagues. So in other words, the confidence to allow the team to generate really quite innovative and strong solutions to problems. That's quite technical. We'll probably leave it there.
No, it's fantastic. Well, I'm going to go very untechnical now and ask you, when you're not leading organisations and you're not being a dad and a husband, is there something else outside of this wild world of leadership and financial service that you love doing now?
Well, as a younger man, loved sailing, but Luxembourg isn't really ideal for that. And love mountaineering. I used to climb very big mountains regularly when I was in the army. So we still go to the mountains, and we'll be going there again this summer. So mountains are a wellspring of contentment for me, and I'm pleased to say for my wife. So we share a view on that. I simply love reading history and typically sort of political military history, no surprise, and European military and political history. And largely because I find it helpful when managing businesses or when working out how to function inside large businesses, because many of these histories are stories of men behaving badly. And I'm afraid to say it is mostly men, or it was. And they have behaved terribly badly. So I recommend those. Adam Tooze is a wonderful, wonderful author. And then also Helen Thompson, I'm reading her book at the moment, which is called Disorder, and I highly recommend it. It's really great. Yeah. And if any of you are members of ALFIE, come to the London conference in October, because Helen will be giving the keynote speech. And I think it's pretty much around that question of disorder. So geopolitics, energy politics, and people trying to do the right thing, or sometimes not trying to do the right thing. That's where I spend my time.
So I'm going to ask one last question. So this wonderful background in military history and reading all about that, what do you think financial services can learn from men behaving badly?
Oh, don't behave badly. I think it's a very bad idea in an industry which has a fiduciary responsibility to investors and clients. Mm-hmm. I think integrity is key in financial services, it's been my great fortune in the companies in which I have worked over my career. I say fortune, you choose as well, choose well. Is that integrity is a fundamental condition for success, and for me, it's my fundamental condition for participation. So we all have a moral compass, and hopefully, I do believe in the large majority, the vast majority of people want to do the right thing, and they understand what the right thing is. They have an effective moral compass. Then just do the right thing. Do it well and do it thoughtfully. Try not to be naive, I would say you wouldn't want some of the characters in my books to be in financial services, that's for sure. People who rather recklessly kick off world wars, as Kaiser Wilhelm II did. And the German historian John Rohl wrote a really astounding, fascinating, wonderful, and very long at about 3,500 pages, very long biography of Wilhelm II. You can see how things go wrong when people and either don't know what right is, or they don't have the right guardrails around them. That's a very interesting time in modern politics as well. Did I answer that question? I think I evaded it.
You did. You may have evaded it a little bit, but I'll let you off. Noel Fessy, thank you so much for bringing your sage words, your wisdom to us here on Flex and City. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for saying that it was wisdom. It may have been a ramble, but thanks for the time.
Thank you.
You just listened to Flex in the City. Catch us on our next episode.